2021, Donald Trump had about $200 million in cash tied up in a partnership with Vornado. If Trump were to sell a property to raise money, that could take months, may require approval by the monitor put in place as a result of the investigation, and require signing off by the Attorney General, Letitia James. It would also likely result in a large tax bill. If Trump's appeal is successful, or the court reduces the amount of money owed, he would be able to recover money he has posted down the road. Judge Arthur Engoron's signed judgment was posted to the court docket on Friday, 1 week after he found Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump liable for fraud in the civil case brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. The judge denied a request from Trump to delay the judgment for 30 days, saying they didn't explain or justify a reason to do so. His lawyers had argued it would harm the New York Attorney General's office and would allow for an orderly process given the magnitude of the decision. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump has appealed his $454 million New York civil fraud judgment, challenging a judge's finding that the former president lied about his wealth as he grew the real estate empire that launched him to stardom and the presidency. The former U.S. president's lawyers filed notices of appeal on Monday, 26th of February, asking New York State's mid-level appeals court to overturn Judge Arthur Engoron's 16th of February verdict in the lawsuit brought by the New York Attorney General Letitia James, and reverse staggering penalties that threatened to wipe out Donald Trump's cash reserves. Trump's lawyers wrote in court papers that they were asking the appeals court to decide whether Judge Arthur Engoron committed errors of law and or fact, and whether he abused his discretion or acted in excess of his jurisdiction. Trump's appeal paperwork did not address whether Donald Trump was seeking to pause collection of the judgment while he appeals by putting up money, assets, or an appeal bond covering the amount owed to qualify for an automatic stay. Messages seeking comment were left with Trump's lawyers and the New York Attorney General's office. Judge Arthur Engoron found that Donald Trump, his company, and top executives, including his sons Eric and Donald Trump Jr., schemed for years to deceive banks and insurers by inflating his wealth on financial statements used to secure loans and make deals. Among other penalties, the judge put strict limitations on the ability of Trump's company, the Trump Organization, to do business in New York State. The appeal ensures that the legal fight over Donald Trump's business practices will persist into the thick of the presidential primary season, and probably beyond, as he tries to clinch the Republican presidential nomination in his quest to retake the White House. If upheld, Judge Engoron's ruling will force Donald Trump to give up a sizable chunk of his fortune. Judge Engoron ordered Donald Trump to pay $355 million in penalties, but with interest, the total has grown to nearly $454 million. The total would increase by nearly $112,000 a day until he pays up. Trump maintains that he is worth several billion dollars, and testified last year that he had about $400 million in cash in addition to properties and other investments. New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat, told ABC News that if Trump is unable to pay, she will seek to seize some of Donald Trump's assets. Trump's appeal was expected. Trump had vowed to appeal and his lawyers had been laying the groundwork for months by objecting frequently to Judge Arthur Ngoron's handling of the trial. During the trial, Trump's lawyers accused Judge Ngoron of tangible and overwhelming bias. They have also objected to the legal mechanics of Letitia James's lawsuit. Trump contends the law she sued him under is a consumer protection statute that is normally used to rein in businesses that rip off their customers. Trump's lawyers have long argued that some of the allegations are barred by a statute of limitations, contending that Judge Arthur Ngoron failed to comply with an appellate division ruling last year that he narrows the scope of the trial to weed out outdated allegations. If Donald Trump is unsuccessful at the appellate division, he can ask the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, to consider taking the case. The appeal is one of Trump's many legal challenges. He has been indicted on criminal charges 4 times in the last year. He's accused in Georgia and Washington, D.C. of plotting to overturn his 2020 election defeat to the Democrat Joe Biden. In Florida, he is charged with hoarding classified documents. Chair defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Last September, the 22nd Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit successfully concluded in the Uzbek city of Samarkand with the formal inclusion of Iran as a permanent member of the organization. A major step for Tehran, the membership was, however, belittled by critics as a move of merely symbolic significance that would bring no benefits in the country's economic sectors, given the security-based nature of the organization on the one hand and a bevy of sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran on the other hand. Now, a few months into Iran's official membership in the SCO, has the country had any improvement in its economy? Or, as predicted by some political pundits, was it useless for Tehran in pragmatic terms? Has the country been better positioned to neutralize sanctions without making concessions to the imposers of those sanctions? Or is it disappointed by the organization still scrambling to find new ways so as to cushion the blow of cruel sanctions? Meanwhile, what are Tehran's obstacles to benefit fully from its SCO membership? These and more on this edition of Iran Today. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was originally formed by Beijing and Moscow as a counterweight to the United States' influence. The SCO's primary goal is to neutralize common threats to the national security and territorial integrity of member states from separatist and radical movements. But to rule out the possibility of any economic benefits is just jumping to conclusions. Although the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was formed as a result of security concerns, the concept of security itself has expanded over time to cover other areas not traditionally considered as security-related ones. Today, security is not merely a military or intelligence issue, but it incorporates a wide range of issues from cybersecurity to trade security.
Наши страны разделяют подходы по большинству.
Our countries share approaches on the most pressing issues on the international agenda and come out with a coordinated position in the UN and regional organizations. Together, we have managed to achieve tangible results in the development and interaction in the economy, trade, industry, science and high technology, environmental protection, cultural humanitarian areas, and many others.
Although the SCO is not currently like NATO or the European Union, where members enjoy certain privileges such as mutual defense or economic integration, Iran's membership means that the country has a wider geographic reach where it can engage with Russia, China, India, and Pakistan, as well as a lot of Central Asian states. Mr. Mohammad Reza Sabzalipour, head of Tehran World Trade Center, had more to say about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. What is the significance of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
سازمان شانگهای بسیار سازمان مهمی است.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a very important body. The SCO is not a household name, but it doesn't mean that it's not an important or a powerful organization. It has a potential to play even a more critical role in the international arena. As for Iran, the country's membership in the SCO has had its own positive impact on its activities in the world. It's an undeniable fact. Regardless of Iran's own status in the world as an individual country, there is no doubt that its membership in the SCO can further improve its place in the world.
The organization's potential for economic connectivity can nullify Washington's sustained efforts to isolate Iran economically. After all, comprising 40% of the world's population and 30% of global GDP, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is the largest regional organization in the world. The organization's commitment to promoting mutual trust, cooperation, and collaboration is evident in the flourishing trade relationships between its members. Mr. Farzin Aghabozorgi, an Iranian financial expert, told us that Iran's membership in the SCO can be a textbook example for other countries.
How do you assess Iran's policy of a pivot to the east? Do you think it can be a game changer for Iran in the face of a hostile Western sanctions?
It's an international lesson for other countries. If you cannot be on good terms with the West, pivot to, for example, the East. You might achieve your goals. What the Islamic Republic has done can be regarded as an international experience. In this regard, Iran can serve as a role model for those countries who might not get along well with the West in the future, for whatever the reason. Instead, they can count on the East as a reliable alternative. Willy-nilly, the East has risen as an economic giant, and joining an organization such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that has members such as China, Russia, and India is a calculated move that can pay off both politically and economically.
Iran's full membership in the SCO is now opening up a new horizon of multilateralism. It dovetails with the country's policy pivot to the east, which seeks, among other things, strategic allies against the hegemony of the West and solutions to the country's banking and trade issues caused chiefly by U.S. sanctions.
In the words of the Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, "One of our priorities today in foreign policy is preferring the East to the West, neighbors to remote countries."
How is Iran's membership in the SCO of significance, especially in terms of economic aspects?
از بابت جمعیتی که حضور دارند در این کشورهای عضو.
The SCO member states make up for over 3.5 billion out of almost 8 billion people of the world. In other words, about half of the world's total population. This is not something to ignore. This is a big market for any country in the world. When you join an organization, you are in fact removing the borders with its member states, a great capacity for exports. In the country, we have a market of almost 85 million people. But when you join an organization such as the SCO, you have access to a market that has nearly 4 billion people, or simply put, half of the world. This is a very important point. The member states are also big in terms of geography. China, Russia, India, Pakistan, and Iran are vast countries. In terms of military power, these countries are among the world's top powers. These factors give great importance to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. As a member, Iran can benefit from such a great organization.
According to the latest figures released by Iran's Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade, the country has exchanged some 64.3 million tons of non-oil products valued at $37.1 billion with the SCO member states in the first 10 months of the current Iranian year, that is between March 21, 2023 and January 20, 2024. In other words, Iran's 10-month trade with the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has increased by 41% in terms of weight and 5.5% in value compared to figures reported in last year's corresponding period. Iran's exports to the bloc accounted for 48.2% of the weight and 44.4% of the value of the country's total exports in the said 10 months. China, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Russia were the top five destinations for Iranian export products in the mentioned period, followed by Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Belarus, and Mongolia. Meanwhile, we met with Dr. Mehdi Bostanchi, CEO of an industrial group active in designing and manufacturing ventilation systems. The group is half a century old and has both domestic and international customers.
Our group is a knowledge-based company that manufactures special ventilators and fans for big industries. We have an active DNR department, which has helped us manufacture high-tech and marketable products.
Dr. Bostanchi said that Iran's membership in organizations such as the SCO can facilitate the exporting process.
Look, joining international organizations can boost our exports to the international markets. As you know, Iran is faced with unfair sanctions by the United States, and the country is experiencing an economic war, so to speak. Under such circumstances, joining an organization like the SCO, which seeks to confront the hegemony of the U.S., can ease the conditions for us.
At the same time, Iran's imports from the SCO reached 9.7 million tons, worth over $19 billion, accounting for 29.7% in weight and 35.2% in value of the country's total imports in the same period. This dynamic exchange of goods highlights the deepening economic ties between Iran and the SCO member states. To what extent do you think Iran can rely on the SCO as an organization that would help the country to prosper more or circumvent unilateral U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran?
When we are talking about sanctions imposed on Iran, we are talking about a regime of sanctions designed to restrict our access to markets belonging to the U.S. allies or to the EU's allies. We, on the other hand, have joined an organization that doesn't recognize such sanctions in the first place. For example, similar sanctions have been imposed on Russia, and Moscow doesn't recognize such sanctions. As for China, the country also doesn't recognize such sanctions, and despite great pressure from the United States, China has kept its commercial ties with Tehran, and the U.S. hasn't dared to punish China for ignoring the sanctions, because it might have negative repercussions for Washington itself. We've joined an organization that intends to confront the U.S. and its hegemony, which manifests itself partly in the form of sanctions. This is a great opportunity for Iran.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of the program where we'll go over some news pieces. Iran's booming trade with Shanghai Cooperation Organization. A new chapter in regional economic growth. The impressive growth in trade between Iran and the SCO states is a testament to the potential of this strategic partnership. As the region continues to navigate the complexities of the global economy, the strengthening of economic ties between Iran and the SCO member states offers a beacon of hope and stability. Iran offers further co-op with SCO in ICT. Tehran Times writes, "The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to boost cooperation with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in developing digital infrastructures such as cross-border optical fiber networks, data centers, and satellite communications. Iran can facilitate the development and expansion of digital infrastructure such as optical fiber networks, 5G technology, and satellite networks through its territory, which is located in the center of the Digital Silk Road." IRIB quoted ICT Minister Issa Zaripour as saying, "Iran and India strengthen bonds through cooperation." Financial Express writes, "Iran and India share a deep-rooted partnership, and the two sides are working together on important projects like the Chabahar port and the International North-South Transport Corridor, which are strengthening the bilateral relationships." The Iranian ambassador to India, Iraj Elahi, emphasized the strong partnership between Iran and India during his address on the occasion of the 45th anniversary of the Islamic Republic of Iran in New Delhi on Friday. He said that the Chabahar port is very important because it connects the Indian Ocean to places like Central Asia. And the International North-South Transport Corridor connects the Indian Ocean to Europe through Iran and Russia. Iran willing to strengthen cooperation and relation with Pakistan. Global Times writes, "Iran's position and policy align in always strengthening cooperation and relations with neighboring countries, including Pakistan." Mehrdad Kiai, the national coordinator of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the SCO Secretariat, told the Global Times in a recent interview, "Although Iran is a new member, having joined the organization only 6 months ago, efforts are already underway to organize events that promote people-to-people exchanges. While specific events have yet to be determined, Iran is committed to strengthening relations within the SCO and fostering a sense of common identity among member states," he noted. And that brings us to the end of this news section. I invite you to go back to the main narrative.
China and Russia, as two major members of the SCO, have established wide-ranging and strong relationship with Iran over the past few decades in areas such as energy, defense cooperation, and geostrategic balancing with the United States.
This organization and the membership of Iran can provide a very good access to more cooperation. So Iran can provide all abilities such as energy and other assets which we have to share with the members.
Iran's accession to the SCO has geoeconomic importance as well. It can help Iran become a hub country by playing a central role in the east-west and north-south transit corridors. How can Iran be an indispensable member for the SCO?
There is no doubt that the region is a major energy hub in the world. In this regard, Iran, with its rich natural resources, can be an interesting option for many countries. For the same reason, Iran can play a crucial role in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. With more investment in the country's oil and energy sectors, Iran can even overtake countries such as Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia in terms of oil exports.
Tehran has assured the SCO members to provide safe, stable, and reliable routes on the North-South corridor and at the same time supply remarkable infrastructure in its southern port, especially the oceanic port of Chabahar. In 2021, Iran's trade with the SCO member states exceeded $37 billion U.S. dollars, which accounts for about 30% of the country's total foreign trade. This is Abbas Argon of Tehran Chamber of Commerce.
What are some of Iran's major export destinations?
Currently, China is the top importer of our products. It's followed by countries such as the UAE, Iraq, Turkey, and India. Our major exports are petrochemical products, which account for nearly 40% of our total exports. Nearly 35% of our exports refer to metal and steel products, followed by agricultural products, ceramic tiles, carpets, and other non-oil products.
As the world watches the unfolding story of Iran's deepening relationship with the SCO, it is clear that it is a tale of ambition, collaboration, and the transformative power of trade. With the lines between these nations continuing to blur, the future of the region's economic landscape looks brighter than ever.
To what extent do you think that Iran becoming a member of organizations such as the SCO or ECO, that is the Economic Cooperation Organization, can help the country in exports?
As for regional and international agreements, I should say that they are definitely to the benefit of the country. If you want to increase your exports, you need to develop your economic ties. You need to have a dynamic diplomacy in the fields of trade and commerce. The more we develop our ties with our neighbors, the more we develop our ties in the region and beyond, the more we can export our products. At the same time, we need to diversify our products to have a deeper reach in the market.
Iran's membership in the SCO is also in tandem with the Chinese policy of Asian people to uphold Asian security. Given its political clout in the region, Iran can play a central role in dealing with security concerns for the SCO members.
I've heard of an expression saying that there is a long queue outside the door of the SCO, and I think this metaphor is not exaggerated. Indeed, many countries out there are showing strong interest in joining the SCO. Why is this happening? I think given the profound global changes that we are witnessing, members of the international community are expecting a new type of international relations based on mutual respect, equity, and justice and mutual benefit. They recognize that the essence of the SCO Charter and Shanghai spirit reflect this new type of international relations.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization works to strengthen security and trade cooperation in Eurasia.
I think international interactions can help us develop our exports. Regarding the SCO, it's a big market, a reliable market with great trade partners. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, like the BRICS, is a good conduit for accessing a big, thriving market. It can help us increase the value and volume of our exports. Organizations such as the SCO can help us out, especially now that we are dealing with sanctions.
Iran's membership in the group would demonstrate the country's good relations with China, Russia, and Central Asia at a time that the West is hell-bent on rendering Iran an isolated country. For example, last August, Tehran and Moscow announced they would start using their own currencies for trade rather than the dollar. Iran and Uzbekistan also signed several cooperation agreements ahead of the SCO summit. And back in June, Iran and Kazakhstan unveiled a new railway network in a further effort to boost trade.
Establishing a system for regional settlements using one or two currencies for trade settlement, or even using unified currencies, can undoubtedly reduce the complexity of regional settlements and greatly promote trading. At the same time, such measures would also help ensure regional financial security, strengthen the stability of the financial system, reduce the impact of fluctuations in the global financial market.
For years, the West has been tightening the screw on Tehran to abandon its peaceful nuclear program, among other things. But with the country's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the West seems toothless in threatening Iran. Iran can now cooperate more intensely with China, Russia, and the rest of the SCO members, such as India and Pakistan, to build immunity against Western sanctions and pressures, a game changer to the chagrin of the West.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again, same times next week and each week after. Till next time, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. This is our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today, we will complete explanation of Surah Jinn, which has 28 ayahs. Number 72 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran, it was revealed in Mecca and has 28 ayahs. The title of the surah indicates that it mainly treats a species of creatures invisible to the human eye and hence called jinn. Endowed with some sort of intelligence and the moral choice to discern good from evil, the jinn have believers and disbelievers amongst them. They were acquainted with the prophets of the past and the previously revealed heavenly scriptures. With the start of the universal mission of Islam, it became incumbent upon them, similar to the human race, to believe in the message entrusted by God Almighty to the mercy unto the whole creation, that is, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. They shall be rewarded or punished according to their specific deeds. The surah ends with ayahs referring to the Almighty Creator's knowledge of the unseen, that is, unknown to all beings. We start from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 23 and 24.
إلا بلاغا من الله ورسالاته ومن يعص الله ورسوله فإن له نار جهنم خالدين فيها أبدا حتى إذا رأوا ما يوعدون فسيعلمون من أضعف ناصرا وأقل عددا.
Say, O Prophet, to the polytheist, I have no duty except to transmit from Allah and to communicate His messages, and whoever disobeys Allah and His Prophet, Indeed, there will be for him the fire of hell to remain in it forever. When they see what they are promised, they will then know who is weaker in supporters and fewer in numbers. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said, God has granted infallibility to the prophets and the imams in view of their highest degree of sincere servitude to Him, and thus they do not invoke anyone else and anything except the Almighty Creator, whose absolute monotheism they preach in order to deliver humanity from darkness and guide them towards the bliss of paradise. The ayahs which we recited to you now quote the Prophet of Islam as saying that his sole duty is to convey the commandments of God to mankind, and whoever disobeys the divine guidelines, especially the polytheists and all other disbelievers, will permanently end up in the eternal fires of hell, while those who earnestly repent and believe are forgiven of their sins. In hell, the polytheist and all those who had disbelieved will see that whatever the prophets had warned about has come true as promised, and finally realize their utter weakness and lack of any supporters, in contrast to the true believers who are the real powerful ones, and against whom these disbelievers used to brag of their supposed power and large numbers. As a matter of fact, the arrogant oppressors will eventually be humiliated and defeated in the world itself with the triumph of the true believers in the end times, an establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice by the Prophet of Islam's 12th and last infallible successor, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him. May God hasten his reappearance. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. Denial of the mission of the prophets and opposition to them is actually denial of Allah and disobedience to His commandments, thereby entailing harsh punishment. Number 2. It is a divine promise that the true believers who do righteous deeds, despite being viewed as downtrodden, will overcome the oppressors and the arrogant, who will finally be weakened and humiliated. And number 3. No arrogant power and its hollow promise should be relied upon, since none can stand against the will of the Almighty Creator. Now let us listen to ayahs 25 and 26 of the same surah.
قُلْ إِنْ أَدْرِي أَقْرِيبٌ مَا تُوعَدُونَ أَمْ يَجْعَلُ لَهُ رَبِّي أَمَدًا عَالِمُ الْغَيْبِ فَلَا يُظْهِرُ عَلَى غَيْبِهِ أَحَدًا.
Say, O Prophet, to the disbelievers, I not know if what you are promised is near, or if my Lord has set a term for it. Knower of the unseen, He does not disclose His unseen to anyone. Here Allah commands the Prophet to answer those who try to ridicule him by asking about the divine promise of punishment for the disbelievers, that no one except the All-Wise Creator knows whether the time of the retribution is near or far. As the next ayah says, the unseen and all events to happen are known only to the Almighty Creator, who does not disclose it to anyone. This means whatever the Prophet knows about the unseen and of the future is only because God has informed him. It is thus clear that if mankind knew when divine wrath befalls, it will be meaningless to set trial and tribulation for them as tests of faith, because in such a case people will measure and plan their deeds, including evil acts, fully confident of repenting before death after freely indulging in sins and vices. From these ayahs, we learn that 1. The Prophet made it clear to the people that only the Almighty Creator knows the unseen and the events to occur, including the time of the retribution promised to the disbelievers. 2. The vast universe is not limited to what is seen and felt, since the countless creatures and phenomena are beyond the reach of human senses and the intellect, despite their scientific progress. 3. The knowledge of the unseen is the exclusive authority of Allah, and He grants part of it to whomever He deems deserving. Hence, prophets do not have the knowledge of future and the unseen by themselves. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 27 and 28 of Surah Jin.
إِلَّا مَنِ ارْتَضَى مِن رَّسُولٍ فَإِنَّهُ يَسْلُكُ مِن بَيْنِ يَدَيْهِ وَمِنْ خَلْفِهِ رَصَدًا لِيَعْلَمَ أَنْ قَدْ أَبْلَغُوا رِسَالَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ وَأَحَاطَ بِمَا لَدَيْهِمْ وَأَحْصَى كُلَّ شَيْءٍ عَدَدًا.
Except to a prophet he approves of, then he dispatches a sentinel, that is, a guardian angel, before and behind him, so that he, God, may ascertain that they have communicated the messages of their Lord, and He comprehends all that is with Him, and He keeps count of all things. In continuation of the previous ayah, here, God the All-Knowing says that He grants part of the knowledge of the unseen to the most deserving of the prophets through divine revelation, especially to the last and greatest of them, that is, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Thus, God has endowed the Prophet of Islam and, through him, his infallible heirs, the Imams of the Ahl al-Bayt, with part of the knowledge of the unseen. Moreover, God has granted infallibility to the Prophets and the Imams, for whom angels have been appointed as sentinels or guards. So, what the Prophet and the Imams have conveyed to us of events before and after creation of mankind, till the end times of life on earth, is the absolute truth, having no connection either to the historians whose chronicles cannot be fully relied upon, or to the soothsayers and fortune tellers who are liars and imposters. The next ayah stresses that the prophets sincerely and without the least mistake convey to the people whatever divine commandments they receive through revelation, and Allah the All-Aware has decreed the meticulous recording of all things. These ayahs teach us that 1. God has granted the prophets part of the knowledge of the unseen in order to make them flawlessly and perfectly accomplish their mission. 2. God has absolute authority and supervision over His prophets, who are assigned guardian angels for their protection. Number 3. Those persons who claim to know the unseen and predict the future are imposters and falsifiers. And number 4. The Almighty Creator's knowledge is infinite and encompasses everything and everywhere. Well, dear friends, on that note, we finish Surah Jin. And next week, inshallah, we will start explanation of Surah Muzammil. Till then, God bless you and goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, justice and fight against corruption, these two virtues necessitate each other. Economic, moral, and political corruption are like tumors in the body of countries and governments. If found in the body of a system of governance, they would constitute a devastating quake and a heavy blow to their legitimacy. And for an establishment like the Islamic Republic that requires beyond the common legitimacy and social acceptance, this is far more serious and fundamental than for any other systems. The temptations of wealth, power, and rank weaken some, even in the most resembling of all governments to Imam Ali's governance, that is, Amir al-Mu'mineen's own government. Thus, the hazard posed by the emergence of such a threat in the Islamic Republic, whose officials once competed each other in revolutionary piety and maintaining a simple lifestyle, has never been and still is not far from probable. This makes the constant presence of an efficient organization with sharp eyes and decisive actions within the three branches of powers, executive, legislature, judiciary, necessary in order to truly fight corruption, especially in governmental bodies.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, the proportion of corrupt individuals among the officials of the Islamic Republic is much smaller than that of many other countries, and particularly to that of the Pahlavi regime, which was totally corrupt and encouraged corruption. And thanks be to God, the agents of this system have mostly stayed clean from it. However, even the slightest corruption is unacceptable. Everyone must know that economic transparency is the precondition for the legitimacy for all officials of the Islamic Republic. Everybody must beware of the evil of greed and avoid illegitimate earnings and supplicate to God to help them in this regard. supervising, and governmental organizations must prevent corruption from being conceived and fight its spread with sincerity and sensitivity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Intisar Abu Sagar, who suffers from pancreatic cancer, is one of the 10,000 Gaza cancer patients waiting to get out of the territory and get treatment abroad. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East I wrote, the Zionist regime's targeting of Gaza's hospitals has left its population of around 2.5 million Palestinians without adequate access to health care. Tens of thousands have been wounded in Israeli regime attacks, but those with long-term and terminal illnesses are also left with nowhere to go for treatment. Cancer patients and others who cannot leave have been left to their fate as the besieged territory's health facilities shut down. The Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital, which served as the most important facility for cancer patients in Gaza, halted operations on October 30 because of the extensive damage caused by air strikes. Dr. Sophie Saik, the hospital's director general, announced the closure on the Facebook, citing infrastructure damage. Middle East I spoke to one family about their experiences living with cancer while under constant threat from the Israelis. Intisar Abu Sagar, 49, was diagnosed with cancer 2 years ago after doctors discovered a tumor on her pancreas. Around 6 months after her diagnosis, Sagar underwent a Whipple procedure that is often used to deal with pancreatic tumors. Abu Sagar's daughter, 29-year-old Hanin, explained, speaking on behalf of her now heavily ill mother, "Doctors removed 5 parts from my mother's body, including the head of the pancreas, the top of the stomach, the intestines, gallbladder, and bile duct. Her intestines were replaced with artificial conduits," she added. Following the successful surgery, Intisar Abu Sagar was left with 12 lymph nodes that were still affected by the cancer. She subsequently underwent 4 months of chemotherapy at the Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital, where doctors were able to control its spread. For a period, therefore, she remained in good health. Following chemotherapy, Intisar adhered to a routine CT screening every 3 months to make sure the cancer did not return. The family dared to feel a sense of optimism until the ongoing conflict began. Soon after, the Zionist regime began its bombing of Gaza following the October 7th events, Intisar Abu Sagher was forced to flee her home in northern Gaza after it was hit by an Israeli regime airstrike. At first, she took refuge in central Gaza and then made her way to Rafah on the Egyptian border. In neither place was she able to have her CT screenings. Hanin recalls, "We found ourselves constantly on the move. Each time we settle in a seemingly secure area, it becomes unsafe and we were forced to relocate again." After becoming displaced, her mother Intisar began feeling pains where she had undergone surgery more than a year and a half earlier. Doctors initially suggested it could be related to tissue in the affected area healing after the surgery. Hanin said, "The pain became increasingly severe. My mother could not sleep at all. We sought medical assistance, but the doctors could not provide CT screenings. They explained that getting CT scans was unfeasible because of the ongoing chaos." With the Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital out of action, the family had to keep an ear out for news of where they could get a CT scan. In January, they learned that the European hospital as well as the Anasser hospital, which was recently stormed by the Zionist regime troops, were performing such scans in southern Gaza. The family managed to reach the latter and Intisar Abu Sagher was checked. During the examination, doctors determined that the cancer had returned and spread to other parts of her body, including various lymph nodes, her spine, lungs and pancreas. Since receiving the news, Intisar's situation has deteriorated significantly. Hanin said, "At the moment, my mother's health is rapidly declining. She is now paralyzed and unable to walk or even sit down." Adding, "We secured a wheelchair for her. Just 2 days ago, we fought to get it for her." The doctor's recommendations are for Intisar to leave Gaza and to get treatment abroad, but so far her name has not been added to the list of people who can leave the territory through Egypt. Hanin explained, "The process is quite long. Egypt issues a list of patients' names and sends them to Israel for approval. Once approved, patients can travel to Egypt. There, they know which country will accept them for their treatment. Typically, it is Turkey, the UAE or Jordan, where cancer patients from Gaza are usually hosted." Intisar is one of at least 10,000 Palestinians with cancer in Gaza who are waiting to get out for treatment. With each day that passes, the cancer spreads through Intisar's body and she slowly loses function of her body. Hanin said, "The doctor informed us that if the cancer had been detected at the start of the aggression, they would have had a chance to control it." Hanin said, "My mom lost over 30 kilograms. She was 78 kilograms and today she is less than 40. Her psychological condition has worsened. She looks at herself and laments over the cancer that is eating her alive without any hope of help.